This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. One of the most sought-after positions for law school grads is that of clerk to a U.S. Supreme Court justice. What do clerks do? How much influence do they have in the opinions handed down by the court? On the program today, we're going to take a look at the role of the Supreme Court's law clerks. Our guest is political scientist Artemis Ward, co-author of Sorcerer's Apprentices, 100 Years of Law Clerks at the United States Supreme Court. The author's research is based on Supreme Court archives, the personal papers of justices and others, and surveys of and interviews with 150 former Supreme Court law clerks. The authors say this look into the role of the high court's clerks is the first comprehensive examination of law clerks at the Supreme Court. It's an important study because the clerks are critical to the functioning of the court. Artemis Ward and his co-author, David Wyden, say, over time, law clerks have come to play an increasingly crucial role in the process of selecting cases to be heard, in decision-making, and in opinion writing. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Artemis Ward. You can join the discussion with the telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you just a bit more about our guest. Artemis Ward is an assistant professor of political science at Northern Illinois University. Together with David Wyden, he is the author of Sorcerer's Apprentices. The publisher is New York University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you'd like to join the discussion this afternoon. Professor Ward, welcome.
Thank you, Celeste. Good to be with you.
How, the first question I would have, and I suppose many people would have the same question, how do the justices select their clerks?
Well, it actually varies individually between among each justice so that they can do it any way they want to do it. The most common practice is that each justice in concert with their current clerks, creates a kind of a short list of applicants that they might want to interview, and then the justices personally interview those people. Occasionally, some justices have delegated that task out to former clerks who conduct the interviews and make the selections on their own. Justice Kennedy does that, for example. He doesn't do any of the direct hiring. He has his former past clerks do the hiring, but most of the justices do it themselves.
Okay. Who's likely to be on the short list?
Well, it's not a big, it's not a lot of guesswork here. Basically, there's seven law schools, quite frankly, that produce most of the Supreme Court law clerks, and so who's likely to be on that list is going to be one of the top graduates from one of those top seven law schools, probably the editor of the Law Review or somebody that graduated at the top, you know, few spots in the class, who's clerked on a lower court for one of the feeder lower court Court of Appeals feeder judges. And there's a group of those who constantly place their clerks at the Supreme Court. So it's a kind of small group of elite, you know, sort of future legal professionals that get these positions.
Okay, so they've got to be bright, accomplished, and ambitious.
Yeah, and well-connected, too.
Yeah. How long does a clerk serve?
Well, the norm has been for clerks to serve for 1 year on the Supreme Court, and that's after serving 1 year previously on the Court of Appeals. In the old days of clerks, 100 years ago when they first started, clerks served, you know, potentially their whole lives. They were there for a long time. But in those days, the clerks didn't really do anything. Nowadays, because the clerks do everything, the thought is that we should minimize those positions to 1 year so that they won't gain too much influence. You know, it takes them about a year to learn the ropes and get up to speed, and then just when they've got it all figured out, we send them on their way to other jobs. So, 1 year.
Yeah. You know, 100 years ago, it was not because of the justices needed help with the workload. It was meant to be to augment a young man's legal education. What was the relationship between justice and clerk 100 years ago?
Well, you know, you certainly make a good point about a young man. That's right. They were all males, certainly. Up until the 1970s, really, is when females started clerking at the Supreme Court, but still very few of those. The relationship, you know, 100 years ago between these young men and their justices was an apprentice relationship. Learning the law in the old days was an apprenticeship model. There were no law schools in America before 1870, and there were no clerks before 1870. So people who wanted to learn the law studied with a lawyer and studied with a judge, and that's how they learned the law. And so the clerk-judge relationship is a kind of an old model of legal education, and that's sort of how it started. It was a sort of mentorship kind of role. But, of course, now it's very different from that.
Yeah. Well, here are a couple of related questions. When did the role of the clerk begin to expand, and why has it grown so?
Well, that's the interesting question. That's really what the book is about. It really documents how, in the last 100 years, clerks went from, you know, just beginning their apprenticeships to having all this influence and responsibility at the court. And there's a number of areas that clerks have influence over. And we can get into each of those. But what essentially happened was seemingly unrelated institutional changes in the way that the court conducted its work led to clerks having to take on more responsibility. So, for example, I'll just give you one. The opinion writing process, which is very controversial, that the law clerks write the opinions that are issued in the names of the justices. Well, that certainly wasn't the case for the first 100 years of the Supreme Court when there were no clerks. And then when clerks first started working there, if they did write one opinion during their year at the Supreme Court, it was as an exercise in learning the law, and the justice looked at it and threw it into the wastebasket. And then what happened is about early 1950s, Chief Justice Vinson decided that he would start assigning opinions equally to all the justices. So instead of whichever justice was the fastest writer would get the most opinions to write, he said, well, you know what, we should all do an equal number of opinions. And then all of a sudden the slow justices, the ones that took forever to write an opinion, couldn't keep up with the workload. They started delegating that task to their clerks to keep up. And they felt the clerks were doing a decent enough job, and so they went ahead and issued those opinions. And over time, that became the norm in the practice, and that's the way it is today.
Yeah. What can you tell us about how the justices view the role of their clerks today?
Well, I think the way to look at it is, I mean, there's certainly still some of this apprentice-mentorship relationship, but the way that I see it from having talked to the clerks and looking at the internal memoranda is that it's a team. It's a group of people working together to try to win cases, quite frankly. And, you know, there are 9 votes on the Supreme Court, and you need 5 of those 9 to win a case. And so the justice and the clerks work together to try to build these coalitions of 5 or more people, 5 or more votes, in order to win cases. And the clerks work with their justice to try to strategize and work behind the scenes and learn about what the other justices and clerks are thinking and how to build coalitions. And that's really what the role is, distilled down to the heart of it. I mean, it's a small working group of people trying to win cases.
Yeah, that role of informal ambassador, that's a big role. That's a very influential role. And that's one of the many interesting findings of your research, is that clerks play a role of informal ambassadors across chambers. What would you like to tell us about this aspect of the life of a clerk?
Yeah, I think this is one of the, I have a whole chapter on this, yeah. And I think it's really interesting. This really hasn't been discussed at all previously. And I call it the clerk network. And what it is, you know, prior to the 1940s, there was no Supreme Court building. Each of the justices worked at home in their own libraries, and the clerk that came to the justice's house. And so the clerks never even knew each other. And then when they moved into their own building and all the justices were in the same building, which they still are today, so were the clerks. And the clerks got to know each other, started having lunch together, and started talking about the cases and what the other justices were thinking and doing, and started, and this is how the network started and developed. The justices saw that, hey, this was really good. It could help them build coalitions. They could get some inside information about what their colleagues were thinking or weren't thinking. And so they did things like build a separate lunchroom for the law clerks. So if any of you have been to the Supreme Court, you've been to the cafeteria and you see a separate room that's, you know, a soundproof glass enclosed room that the clerks can have their breakfast and lunch in, so that they can talk freely amongst themselves without fear that reporters will overhear what they're saying. And the justices have fostered this atmosphere. They want the clerks to network and discuss. And it's not uncommon for clerks to constantly be reporting back to their justice. Hey, I spoke to Justice Souter's clerk yesterday, and he tells me that Souter's willing to go along with us if we say this or if we do this. And that is the clerk network.
Well, very influential there. And, of course, very political.
Yes.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today is Artemis Ward, co-author of Sorcerer's Apprentices, 100 Years of Law Clerks at the United States Supreme Court. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. This might be a little bit off the subject, but it has to do with the recent trend in things like law and judges' opinions. It seems like more and more recently, especially with all of these lawyer sorts of shows on TV, the idea is not so much as to determine the verdict of a case based on what's right or wrong according to the law, but the lawyers seem to be more concerned with winning the case. And what you were just discussing about forming alliances and things like that, could you discuss a bit about why that is more important than actually learning the laws, how to interpret them, and actually how to use the laws to determine the verdict of a case, as opposed to just the social aspect and politics of the judges and lawyers themselves?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. I'm glad you brought that up. There tends to be this sense out there among the public that, you know, judges are objective and neutral and above partisan politics, and that they simply look at the facts of the case and then apply the law in a kind of neutral, objective way and reach an outcome. Of course, we know that that's not the case, because we see things like the Supreme Court deciding presidential elections by a vote of 5-4. And so there is differences of opinion about how to interpret the law. It's not raw political power, but it is coalition forming, and it is politics within the context of the law. So the law is the vehicle and creates the ground rules and in some ways constrains judges in what they can and can't do in a way that maybe presidents and executives and legislators are not constrained. Judges are constrained and do care about the law, but it's not sort of a slot machine jurisprudence, if you will. The politics and the law are both intertwined, and so that's something we should keep in mind.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. That is a very good question, and that leads me to talk with you, Professor Ward, now about one of the chapters in the book that is a case study of this very issue, and that is you and your co-author looked into the case Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Why did you select that case for study, first of all?
Well, obviously, abortion is a big topic, a very political topic in society and in the law, and we're all familiar with Roe versus Wade, which is a case from the 1970s that said that women have a constitutional right to abortion. Planned Parenthood versus Casey was a case from the 1990s, about 20 years later, that many thought would overturn Roe versus Wade. There had been changes at the Supreme Court, more Republican-appointed justices, and people felt that Casey would be the case to undo Roe. And what I found in looking at the internal memoranda from the Supreme Court is I found a lot of politics inside the court with regard to that case. So Justice Blackmun is the author of Roe versus Wade. Well, he's on the court for Casey 20 years later. And his law clerk, and I have this memo in the appendix to the book, his law clerk is writing him and saying, you know, the conservative justices, they want to overturn Roe versus Wade. You know this, I know this, we all know this. But they don't really want to do it now in 1992 because it's a presidential election year. They'd like to wait until after the presidential election and then overturn it. But we have to force their hand. If they're going to overturn Roe, let's make them do it now in a presidential election year so that it hurts them at the ballot box, because the American people will be upset that the conservatives have overturned Roe. So she recommends to Justice Blackmun, you should vote to grant this case. You should join with the conservatives, or you should want to hear this case. You shouldn't vote to overturn Roe, but you should push to have this case heard and force the conservatives to decide it now. So that's an example of raw politics at the Supreme Court, concerns about presidential elections playing a role in the decisions that the justices make.
Hmm. Are clerks ideologically similar to the justice they work for?
Yes. In fact, that was something that we looked at with the survey data. We asked the clerks that we surveyed, what was your ideology? Were you a liberal? Were you a conservative? Were you a moderate? When you applied for your clerkship, and we looked at the clerks and we looked at the justices they ended up working for, and we saw remarkable congruence there, that there is ideological congruence, and it's hard to say, why does that happen? If a justice is looking at an application from a clerk, how can you tell whether that clerk's a liberal or conservative? Well, that clerk may belong to certain organizations,
mm-hmm.
like the Federalist Society, which is a conservative organization. That clerk may have worked for a lower court judge who is a Republican or a conservative judge. And so that sends a signal to a justice, hey, this is someone that I can trust. This is someone who I can bring along on board, who I know is going to see things the way I see them. And so we found remarkable levels of ideological congruence between justices and clerks. But, that said, there are still justices, and Justice Scalia is one, who likes to have at least one clerk every year who's not, who doesn't see the world the way he does. He likes to have one who might challenge him. But certainly ideology is taken into account one way or the other.
Yeah. I think I would, too. I'd want to have the view from the other side in my chambers.
Yeah, but imagine if you were a liberal justice and you had nothing but conservative clerks.
Well, that doesn't work either.
then you'd find them consorting with the enemy, if you will.
But
each justice gets four clerks and the chief gets five clerks, so that gives you a luxury of balancing it any way you like.
Yeah. Now, John Roberts' predecessor, William Rehnquist, he clerked for Justice Robert Jackson. Jackson appointed to the bench by Franklin Roosevelt. What's known about Rehnquist's experience as a law clerk?
Well, I go into this in the book, and it's really interesting. Rehnquist, when he clerked for Jackson, right after he finished his clerkship, wrote an article in U.S. News and World Report saying, hey, the clerks have a lot of influence, and they're, exercising power behind the scenes here, and the American people ought to know about this. And how funny is it that he then became the Chief Justice years later? And when asked about that, hey, I thought you said clerks had too much influence. What are you going to do about it? He said, well, I was just young, and, they don't really have that much influence. And, I make sure that I make the decisions, and I tell them what to do. And so he seemed to have done a bit of an about-face between the time he had been a clerk and the time he went to be Chief Justice. But that may just be a question of maturity. We found that the clerks sometimes do inflate their importance and do feel that they have more power than maybe they actually have. So that may have been some of that with regard to Rehnquist's article from the 1950s. And so we get into that in the book. It's kind of fun.
Yeah. Now, when he became a justice and then chief justice, how did he employ his clerks?
Well, one of the things he did was he didn't take the maximum number of clerks that he was allowed under the law. And that's very interesting. He always took one clerk less than he could, so that even though now Chief Justice can have five, he never had more than three or four himself. And that's one way to maybe perhaps minimize clerk influence, is to keep the number down. Having been a clerk himself, when he first got to the Supreme Court in the early 1970s, he knew how it worked. He'd been there personally, and so. That perhaps gave him an insight into the role of clerks at the Supreme Court that maybe other justices didn't have. But he didn't have a problem with clerks at all at the end, and he delegated to them, and they wrote the opinions, and he gave them strict deadlines. I want this case in 10 days. I want you to write this 30-page opinion in 10 days and hand it to me,
Yeah. Maybe you could walk us through the process. We can imagine ourselves in the Supreme Court building and the petitions are rolling in. How many are there each year? And then maybe you could give us a kind of an outline of where the process goes from when the petition comes into the building and where it goes from there?
Yeah, that's a great question. When the clerks show up in the summer to begin their clerkship, the justices aren't even there, which is really interesting. The clerks show up at the Supreme Court, and the old clerks from the last year are just finishing up, and maybe one of them remains to sort of show the new clerks the ropes kind of thing. And you talk about the petitions, and that's really where the job begins. So in the summer, the petitions are rolling in. And every year, the court gets 10,000 petitions. So you're talking about, say, between 250 and 300 petitions a week rolling in to the Supreme Court per clerk. Now, when I say, I shouldn't say per clerk, but rolling in each week, and then each clerk has to divide those up. So what the court has is something called the cert pool, and these petitions are called memos for certiorari, so we call them cert for short. And the court has decided since the 1970s to pool these clerks. So currently the Supreme Court has 37 clerks, and if you count Justice O'Connor, the retired justice's clerk, that's 38 clerks. Almost all of those clerks, except Justice Stevens' clerks, they all get together and they divide up these petitions. And so each of them fills out a memo that distills the petition down to maybe a paragraph, maybe a page, and says, these are the issues in the case. This is what I think we ought to do. I think we ought to take this case, or I don't think we should take this case. And that memo is then sent around to all of the justices. So one clerk, and these clerks are, the clerk is selected randomly, writes the memo and sends that memo to all the justices who participate in the pool. And it's all of them except Justice Stevens. And they do this throughout the term. Every week, the 250 to 300 petitions are rolling in and are divided up among the clerks. So that means each of these clerks is looking at about five petitions a week. That, you know, and we're talking about, dozens and dozens of pages of legal briefs from petitioners and respondents and lower court opinions and trial court records and other briefs that are submitted by interested parties. And the clerks have to distill this down, and they have to do a handful of these every single week. So that's the beginning part of their job, and that keeps them busy throughout the term. Then they have to start writing opinions eventually as the court decides cases as the term progresses. And as I was saying, Chief Justice Rehnquist used to give his clerks 10 days to write a 30-page opinion. So on top of the cert memos, petitioner memos, the clerks are writing opinions. They're also preparing their justices for oral arguments. So the cases that are argued before the justices, and you can go to the court and you can watch those, the clerks prepare something called a bench memo, which is almost like a preliminary opinion. You know, it can be as many as, you know, dozens of pages of discussing the legal arguments and prepping their justices as potential questions that they might want to ask. So really the clerks are reviewing the cert petitions, writing the bench memos, and then writing opinions and working behind the scenes through the clerk network to negotiate and bargain. So as the term progresses, they get busier and busier and busier, essentially.
Yeah. So research and writing, they're involved.
Yeah, and politics, right? Politics, the negotiations,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in White Heath on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. I've just been listening. My latest Atlantic Monthly, there was a short essay on this very issue of clerks and how they are really doing so much of the work, and the justices are able then to travel around giving speeches and writing books and doing all kinds of things. In years past, there used to be one clerk for each justice. Now they each have four clerks, and it seems like we're getting our legal opinions. We might be getting our legal opinions from college, just graduated college lawyers, and is that a concern of yours? From watching the process or not?
That's an excellent question. I think the first thing that we should realize is just, you know, in general, how politics, how government works. So it's not just that at the Supreme Court, young, fresh out of college people are writing the words that the justices use and doing the work. That happens in the executive branch and in the legislative branch as well.
Uh-huh.
Members of Congress and the president, they don't write the words that they say, and they don't do the research that leads to legislation and speeches and so forth. These are also young college graduates that do all of that work. But the difference between what happens in the law, in the judicial branch, versus the other two branches is And the judicial branch of the law matters, right?
Exactly.
In a way that it doesn't perhaps matter as much in the other branches.
Uh-huh.
When the Supreme Court hands down a ruling, the words in that opinion are supposed to guide lower court judges. And of course, all of us in society, we are supposed to follow their words.
Uh-huh.
And so if those words, if we know that those words are being written by young people fresh out of law school, then maybe we are not going to give them as much weight. Maybe
yes.
We're less likely to follow what the Supreme Court says.
Uh-huh. And here, another thing that was pointed out in this article by Stuart Taylor and Benjamin Wittes, I think, or something like that, is that in 1945, they were looking at taking 160 cases. Today, they have 80. So it's not like they're overburdened with, work. It's they have the time, the justices have the time to do their work, but they've been delegating it to these young people. And exactly what you pointed out, we have to reconsider when we look at what they're handing down. And
Yeah, I mean, I think that you make a good point. The justices don't see their role as one of sort of writing down words or doing legal research. They really see their role as making decisions. They are decision makers. And in the same way that a partner at a law firm delegates a lot of that work to the junior associates in the firm, the justice does the same by delegating to his clerks or her clerks the writing and the research. But it's the justice that makes the ultimate decision.
Exactly. It pointed out what John Paul Stevens said about his role. He said, part of the reason I write my own drafts is for self-discipline. I don't really understand a case until I write it out. And so I think, there you go.
Yeah, Justice Stevens is really quite unique in that sense. But then again, he's been on the court longer than anyone else.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, he does very often write his own opinions. Some of the other justices will, too, occasionally. One of the interesting phenomena that we found is that because clerks are writing the opinions now more than ever, the opinions have taken on a kind of formal, technical, almost law review-like quality. And if you've ever picked up a law review and sort of seen what law students write and law professors write, these judicial opinions have taken on a very kind of standard form and technical form, and the days of an Oliver Wendell Holmes or Louis Brandeis, writing this these sort of maybe shorter opinions, maybe more pithy opinions, those days are gone. And so uh-huh. Now every opinion is long and involved and technical and standard.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for the call and those questions. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. And on this June 21st, 2006, we have a severe thunderstorm watch to tell you about. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for all of northern Illinois and portions of northwestern Indiana, effective until 6 p.m. Central Time this evening. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch includes the following counties in Illinois: Ford, Iroquois, Livingston, and McLean. A severe thunderstorm watch in effect for all of northern Illinois and portions of northwestern Indiana until 6 p.m. Central Time this evening. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest in this portion of the program, Professor Artemus Ward, co-author of Sorcerers, Apprentices, 100 Years of Law Clerks at the United States Supreme Court. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk now with another listener, caller in Champaign on line 2. Hi.
Hello.
Yes, go
Very
ahead.
Very interesting program. And I think I had thoughts along the lines of the previous caller, but it led me to a different kind of question. That is oversight for the clerks. And how, you have said before, and I think we all know, you need some connections to get there, in addition to a wonderful education and good marks. But again, the oversight. And would you know how many clerks have been sent home in that, in the, say, let's say the last 25 years? And that's just basically my question, because I think the clerks are getting more and more influence.
Well, what did you mean exactly by sent home?
Deemed, oh, I don't want to say incompetent, not up to the task.
Oh, I see what you're
saying, yeah.
I'm
not talking about somebody who was naughty or caught smoking pot. I mean, who just was not able to do the job.
Yeah,
that just doesn't happen. And in fact, that's actually what drives the hiring process for the justices. They're really terrified that they're going to hire someone who's not going to be up to the task. And that is why the clerks come from the top law schools in the country and graduated at the top of their class and were editors of the Law Review and have already clerked for a year on the Court of Appeals. And that's why the justices do it, because they will tell you they have to have people who can hit the ground running and who they can rely on totally. And so that's why you don't see Supreme Court law clerks from less prestigious law schools or who did not graduate near the top of their class.
Well, that I understand, but I think it's quite remarkable that there's never been somebody who wasn't up to the mark. That's a wonderful record that their hiring practice has been 100%.
The other question, though, that this caller raises is very interesting. What can you tell us about oversight? How much oversight do the justices employ?
Well, that is a very interesting question. And I talk about this in the book, that it's really unique to each justice. Each justice runs their chambers completely in a way that, you know, that they choose to run it. So, for example, Justice Scalia runs his chambers and uses his clerks and monitors his clerks in the way that he chooses to do so, and no other justice can say anything about what he does. So that being said, and I talk about some examples of this in the book, some justices provide more oversight than others. There's been a couple examples in history of justices who, quite frankly, didn't give their clerks very much direction in, let's say, opinion writing, and didn't really edit and check the opinions that carefully. And opinions were sort of, issued without much input and much oversight from the justices. That does happen, but that tends to be rare, and that does tend to be idiosyncratic, depending upon the justice that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon. I've got someone else waiting to talk with us. Line 1, Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I guess I have a couple of things I'd like to throw out, and one of them is, do the justices like make A and B teams out of their clerks at all, and, you know, take the opposite argument sort of thing? I assume that's done, since that's kind of Socratic and come right out of the law school theory. But the other thing is, you mentioned this socializing amongst the clerks. I was wondering what kind of connections, the informal connections, some of the justices and their clerks have. I'm particularly struck by the fact that I believe there are, is it 5 Catholics on board, and at least 3 of them are sort of specifically fellow travelers with rather conservative Opus Dei type religions. Roberts actually followed a priest who was moved. He's not counted typically as being Opus Dei, whatever that means, you know, but I wonder, do they pray together, as they say, and that kind of thing? And I have something pressing now, so I'll listen and see how you handle it. Thank you.
Yeah, those are both very interesting questions. The first part about sort of justices dividing their clerks up among the sort of A team and the B team, generally that doesn't happen. You might think that, these are young folks fresh out of law school with maybe the cutting-edge legal theories and ideas that they can bring in, and there can be a kind of a Socratic dialogue within a chambers. That generally doesn't happen, though, as I mentioned before, Justice Scalia, for example, will like to have maybe one clerk who might be a bit of a contrarian. Generally, the clerks are ideologically congruent, And but, you know, that being said, justices do want to discuss cases with their clerks, and they do discuss cases with their clerks. So, yeah, there is certainly a dialogue that goes on, but it's not really an either-or or a sort of contrarian Socratic dialogue. The second question about the sort of informal connections is a very interesting one. And I think just looking at Chief Justice Roberts and his background and how he came to be Chief Justice gives us a little bit of a window on those informal connections. Here's a guy who, you know, went to Harvard Law School and was at the top of his class and ended up clerking for Justice Rehnquist. And what he gained from that was, you know, once you clerk for a Supreme Court justice, you remain part of that justice's family. Every year the clerks have dinners, and they come back to Washington with their families, and they meet with the justice, and it becomes a whole weekend event, and they get to know each other personally, and letters of recommendation are written. If you're a former clerk and you're applying for a job or something, you'll ask your justice for a letter, these sort of things. And so John Roberts went from clerking for Justice Rehnquist to positions in Republican administrations in the executive branch. And then ultimately was rewarded back to the judicial branch with appointments by Republican presidents and culminating now in his chief justiceship. So these informal networks are very strong and very powerful, certainly not only in the legal field, but in all walks of life, as you know. As far as other types of informal networks, whether they be religious or other, there are certainly some of that. And I go into some detail in one of the beginning chapters about the sort of backgrounds and characteristics of clerks and how that plays into their hiring and other things. So good questions.
Yeah. Now, given the influence that clerks have today, I'm thinking back, you know, to the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings we had. When was it? This past year?
Yeah.
For two justices. Does the Judiciary Committee, given how much influence clerks have, do the members of the committee ever ask about what qualities the nominee would seek in a clerk, the role of the clerk, and the prospective justice's oversight of the clerk?
Well, unfortunately, not really, and that's something that I lament in the conclusion to the book. You know, I'd like to see a little bit more of that by Congress, but the fact is that Congress, and certainly when you talk about confirmation hearings, right, Chief Justice Roberts' confirmation hearing or Justice Alito's Senate confirmation hearing, there was hardly any discussion of law clerks at all there. And why not? Well, because those venues, I mean, what you're suggesting is that the Judiciary Committee ought to sort of get into substantive issues about how the court conducts its business. But that's not what the Judiciary Committee is concerned about for confirmation hearings. They're concerned about politics and confirming nominees or not confirming nominees and votes and re-election and TV coverage and those sort of things and playing the constituents. And that's what confirmation hearings are about, not to get at substantive issues about how one might use their law clerks. But that being said, the Supreme Court does actually go before Congress every year to make sure that they get money to run their building and to run their staffs, and so two of the justices every year go before the House a committee in the House, and they're often questioned about their clerks. And recently, there's been some talk about the lack of minority law clerks at the Supreme Court, and the House committee has asked justices about this. And so the justices do have to come before Congress to get money, as we all do in society, and that's where Congress really does have some power. They can control budgets and cut budgets and threaten and those sorts of things. But those threats tend to be hollow, and the judiciary tends to get the money and the resources that they want.
Yeah. One of the things that you'd like to see is increased disclosure of the court's internal operations and at the same time of the role that clerks play. What kind of information are you talking about, and do you think the court would be amenable?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question, and one of the things I talk about in the conclusion is more disclosure, for example, in the area of the petitions that you mentioned earlier. We know the court gets 10,000 petitions a year, but they only hear 100 cases. So what about those 9,900 cases? What happened to those cases? Well, the only thing the court tells us is that the petition was denied. And they just issue these order lists every week that just say petition denied, petition denied, petition denied. And they don't give us any reasons. We don't know if there was a vote taken or anything. And so what I'm... But we do know that every petition had a law clerk writing a memo about it and making a recommendation. So I'm suggesting, hey, maybe we should publish those memos so that we can see what happened there. And also publishing those memos might also force the clerks to do a little bit better job with those memos in the sense of maybe not being as slanted or as ideological or as biased as some of the memos appear to be at times. So that's one example of more disclosure with regard to the role of clerks.
Yeah, and how do you think the court would respond to that suggestion?
Well, it's never going to happen, is it? you know, that's the great thing about sort of suggesting reforms at government, certainly reforms of the Supreme Court. You know, the Supreme Court is moves terribly slowly with regard to its business and even more slowly with regard to its internal practices. So I don't, you know, there have been all kinds of reform proposals over the years to change the Supreme Court to make it work better, and it's, you know, going to happen over the dead body of some of these justices, as Justice Souter says, with regard to cameras in the courts, right? It'll happen over my dead body.
Yeah.
They like the way it works, and they like their anonymity, and they like their control over what happens inside the court.
Yeah. I want to go back, one last question, and we'll have to be brief. I want to go back to our listener who called from White Heath this afternoon with a really interesting question about, it went to the heart of the credibility of the court. And I guess my question is, given the potential for abuse, you know, should we be alarmed? How alarmed should we be about the state of affairs?
Well, this is one of the things. I mean, this is really what I come down in at the end, in the conclusion to the book, is that it's in the interest of the Supreme Court to have more disclosure, because the justices will tell you that, you know, we're the ones making the decisions. The clerks really don't have that much influence, you know, if any. And so what I'm suggesting is, well, then let's have more disclosure. Let's have more sunshine. Let's illuminate the process better and make things more public so that the justice can show that indeed clerks don't have as much influence as we might suspect they do, because these things are taking place in secret behind the scenes.
Yeah.
So that's really so I think it could be a good thing for the institution: more disclosure, more sunshine, more information.
Okay, that's where we have to leave it. We're out of time, unfortunately. Professor Ward, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Celeste.
My pleasure. Professor Artemis Ward and David Wyden are the authors of Sorcerer's Apprentices, 100 Years of Law Clerks at the United States Supreme Court.